putting things out there where there's going to be a vote, when people tangibly say in a vote, no, we are voting against animals, I don't see how that helps at all. If I was animal agribusiness, I probably would be thrilled to have ballot measures where animals lost.
Hmm.
Because they don't, there's no Overton window being changed when the animal side loses. It's the opposite in my mind. It's animal agribusiness is going to go to companies and say, listen, I know you were pressed to make all these changes, but didn't you just see this vote? People aren't so sure about these changes anymore. Hey, didn't you just see this vote? People have kind of changed their mind when it comes to animals. Maybe they thought this way about animals years ago, but look at this vote.
Hi, my name is Amy.
And my name is James.
And this is How I Learned to Love Shrimp, a podcast about promising ways to help animals and build the animal advocacy movement.
Josh Bork is a busy man. On the side of being an influential figure in the farm animal protection movement, he's also co-founded Eat Just, a food company well known for their plant-based egg replacement, as well as their cultivated meat. But today we speak to him about a promising new strategy that he's trying out at the Accountability Board, which is shareholder activism. In a nutshell, that involves doing something that seems quite counterintuitive, buying shares in the largest food companies that use animals as products, and then trying to use those shares to make them change. On top of that, we also speak about the successes he's had through ballot initiatives in the US, such as Prop 12 in California, the EAT Act, as well as US politics more generally. This has been a really fascinating conversation, so I highly recommend checking it out and listening all the way through. So today we are joined by Josh Bork, who is the co-founder and CEO of the Accountability Board. Previously, he was vice president of farm animal protection at the Humane Society of the US. And if that was enough, he's also a co-founder of Eat Just, a food technology company. Welcome, Josh.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me, James. Thanks for having me, Amy.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
So we're very, very happy to have you here. It's very exciting. We'd like to start everyone off with a similar question, which is, what's an animal-related view you've changed your mind on recently?
You know, I got to tell you that I wouldn't say I changed it completely, but more recently, certainly in the United States, it has been enforced on me that we have to get engaged in politics and legislation more than ever. I've certainly believed that. For many years of my time working for animals, I'm sure we'll talk about later. I led ballot measure campaigns for farm animals in the United States and worked to pass laws throughout the country to ban cages and crates. At the same time, it's one thing to work to pass certain laws for animals. It's another to get engaged actually with the legislators themselves, with the politicians themselves, and to get intertwined with them for many reasons. One is there's probably animal related action going on, and perhaps most importantly, there will be, and we can't play catch up. We have to be part of this system. And as much as we might want to decry, politicians and like, oh, I don't want to get involved in that dirty business. Well, now who is involved? Big animal agribusiness. They have no problem getting involved in that business. So we can either turn our head and like, oh, I don't want to do that type of stuff and just let us lose, and more importantly, let the animals lose, or we can actually get involved. So I would say, James, to answer your question, more than ever, I think we need to get involved in politics and legislation.
Very cool. And did something happen that made you feel this way? Was it some piece of legislation that we lost or either won because we did? And how did this actual change happen?
Well, in the United States, there's something called the EATS Act that is happening. In our country, we passed laws throughout many parts of our country, from California to Massachusetts and many states in between, that banned the confinement of egg-laying hens, mother pigs, and or calves raised for veal, and in numerous states, banned the sale of eggs, pork, and or veal from caged animals. And so certainly in the United States, they have been the most critical pieces of legislation for farm animals in history. Actually, many of those states, the strongest laws in the world for farm animals. So that's good. We're moving in a good direction. But as we all know, big agribusiness doesn't just sit back and say, woe is me, we're losing, let's just capitulate. No, they keep fighting back too. And in the United States, they're trying to pass what's called the EATS Act, what the EATS Act would do is to wipe out all those laws and prevent those laws from ever being passed again. So it is the existential threat that we face in the United States for legislative victories for animals. You know, what I say here in the US is that it is the meteor headed towards Earth for animals. Because not only if it could wipe out laws in the United States, but imagine the reverberations across the world if the United States goes backwards in farm animals. Mm. That will give other countries an excuse, hey, maybe we shouldn't start moving forward on animal issues when the United States is going a different direction.
Yeah.
So the EATS Act is that threat. And I wish I was even more engaged in the United States Congress in the past than I have been. I'm trying to do a little bit of catch up here, but we're waging quite a battle to fight this thing off.
Why do you think there was such hesitancy in the past? Do you think it's organizations worried that siding or maybe being seen to deal with one side over the other would polarize some of their supporters? Do you think there's a specific reason orgs have been maybe kind of hesitant to deal with policy in the past?
I think organizations have been active to some extent in Congress in the past, and certainly some more than others. I think a major reason is severalfold. One is that things move very slowly when it comes to the United States and Congress.
Mm.
So you can work on an issue for 10, 20 years, and you can understand the frustration, like, hey, we should do stuff more in the state level, the local level, which, by the way, I think is great, too. And that's where I've devoted my time. I also think that it seems so big thinking of working in Congress, the United States. You know, it's like, it's one thing to work in your local municipality, your local state house. But when you think of big Washington, D.C., you think of the big power brokers and the big time lobbyists and the big corporations. You don't think like little old me can go in there and make a difference. But you know what? You can. Especially if you know how to play the game the way they play the game. And I think that the more people step in to try, the more they realize, wait a second, I actually can do that. And there's a big leveling out that happens in DC, because if you're actually active and you actually engage in the very practices that our opposition does, guess what? Those politicians start looking at you more as equals as well.
Mm.
And so I think we can start changing that a little bit more. We have been doing some things in the past. Certainly some people have been leaders in the United States that I'm proud to call friends. At the same time, I think we can certainly do more.
Yeah, makes sense. Just a quick clarifying question. Is EATS an acronym? Is that standing for something?
It does stand for something. It stands for Ending Agricultural Trade Suppression. And that's pretty clever, right?
Whatever that means.
Wow.
A lot of fancy words that basically, in essence, say that states can't pass their own agricultural laws.
Right.
That the only ones that can do it is the federal government. But okay, that sounds interesting. Well, hey, pork industry, do you want the federal government to pass laws to improve the treatment of animals? Oh, no, I don't want that either. So they don't want states to pass laws to improve the treatment of pigs, and they also don't want the federal government to pass laws to improve the treatment of pigs. Where does that leave it? Leaves no one out there improving the lives of these animals who, as you both know and your audience knows, are forced to live horrible lives of misery, being confined in cages that they can't move. So yes, that's what the acronym is, Amy, and pretty clever for them to figure that out. At the same time, you know, acronyms are pretty normal in DC, so it's not too clever.
Sure.
Cool. Well, I think we'll spend a bunch of time talking about the EATS Act in US politics, especially for us UK or like non-US peasants who don't understand the ins and outs of UK or US politics. So I'm excited to learn more. Anyway, but yeah, so what is your journey into the Accountability Board? And maybe if you want to give a quite quick high level of what the Accountability Board is and how you ended up there, and also your prior work at the Humane Society of the United States.
I was at the Humane Society of the United States for about 18 years. For much of that time, I led the farm animal work at the organization. So there, I led campaigns to get food companies to enact animal welfare policies, such as going cage-free on their eggs or gestation crate-free on their pork, or add more plant-based options. I also led the legislative campaigns, like ballot campaigns in the United States. And for those, thank you, James, for reminding me that you have a global audience, which I'm so thrilled about your podcast. In the United States, we have something called a ballot measure, and that's where people can vote in an election for a certain law. So not just vote for a politician to get elected, they can vote for a certain law to occur. So I led a ballot measure called Proposition 12 in California. That was in 2018. It was meant to, and we won, to pass a law that banned the sale of eggs, pork, and veal from caged animals. It was a big battle against agribusiness. I did debates against agribusiness up and down the state on TV, radio, in front of editorial newspaper boards. We had to raise tens of millions of dollars to do commercials on TV, online. We had more than 1,000 volunteers do phone knocking, giving out leaflets, making phone calls on the campaign. And in the day, we won. We got 2/3 of the vote. We won, and then we passed similar laws in about a dozen states after that. So that certainly was a big part of my life at the Humane Society of the United States. Also, that law was challenged. That was challenged by the pork industry. It's a growing theme we have here, but the pork industry not being thrilled with these efforts. It sued to try to overturn California's law, went all the way up to the Supreme Court. So I spent about a year of my life working on that lawsuit to try to prevail in the United States Supreme Court. The tremendous colleagues working.
And when did that happen? So the ballot, Prop 12 passed in 2018. And when was the Supreme Court challenge?
So you're right. Passed in 2018. Lawsuits started being filed right afterwards to try to overturn it. And then the Supreme Court took the case, and it was heard in front of the Supreme Court in 2022. So about 4 years later, it was heard at the Supreme Court. And, in spite of a lot of cynicism and folks who are Supreme Court experts and, the political, the political insiders of the day all thought we were going to lose. But we didn't. We won. At the end of the day, we won. It was a huge upset for animals. And because of prevailing, these laws can remain in place. At least they're not being overturned by Supreme Court. That EATS Act we talked about could overturn those laws. So anyway, James, after the Supreme Court heard the case, that was in October, they didn't rule until later. But once they heard the case, your time is over. Like, you did your case, you made your argument, you did the media around it, and then you just wait. So it was during that waiting time that I co-founded the Accountability Board. Here's the theory of change that we have is that we are very proud of Proposition 12 and the other laws that we have in place in the United States. At the same time, we likely aren't going to pass those type of laws in many parts of the world. It's probably not going to happen in China or Brazil or Eastern Europe or so much of our planet's surface is likely not going to be covered by certain laws to ban, as an example, cages and crates. So how do we affect animals in those places of the world? And by the way, even in places where they have laws in place, how do we make sure those laws are actually followed and they're not overturned? And in our mind, it came down to this. Corporations act on a global scale. So we might not be able to get China to pass Proposition 12, but you know what? If we get every food company operating China to say, listen, we're going 100% cage-free. We're eliminating gestation crates in our supply chain too. We're adding more plant-based meals. Guess what? That affects Chinese agriculture as well. And same thing with all parts around the world. So the Accountability Board is an entity that is changing the way animals are raised globally. And how we do it is through the investment framework. So we are shareholders of every major publicly traded food company in the United States, Canada, Australia.
How many is every major company for a food business company?
Certainly, we're starting out with 100.
Wow.
And we're increasing it, seems like, on a monthly basis. And because we're investors, we can actually engage in aggressive shareholder activities to push companies to move on issues they otherwise wouldn't move on.
And are you having to do this kind of incognito, or is it like very transparent that it is the board, the accountability board organization that's a part of these shareholder, that is a shareholder of these companies?
Well, it's certainly transparent to the companies, because I personally reach out to the CEOs and the board of directors and other executives. So they certainly know we're investors and they are well aware of what we're pushing for.
And you're on the podcast, and we have a global reach of like millions of people. So everyone will hear this. So it's definitely not a secret.
And listen, when all these CEOs you tune in and listen to this podcast, they're gonna probably nod and like, yeah, we know about these guys already. Absolutely. And they'll be like, James, Amy, tell me more. But that's after they frown that I'm actually a guest. So here's the thing with these food corporations is that they constantly adapt just like animal advocates adapt. You know, before there were certain things that got them to move, you know, maybe a protest here, maybe a Facebook campaign there, an action there. And sometimes those tactics still work and that's great. At the same time, they adapt by being able to fight off those tactics a lot easier than they have in the past. And so as they adapt to be able to fight off the voices of change that are being thrusted on them, we have to adapt as people who do want change to occur to make this world a more humane place. And I feel that being a shareholder and pushing companies from the inside is a way that it's more challenging for them to adapt to, because we have a legal ability to push them. We have a legal authority that they can't avoid, that we can press them on issues. And at the end, sure, maybe they might not move, but they can't ignore it. By law, they have to react. By law, their actions they have to do to either agree with us and move, or they actually have to repel the efforts, but there's still actions that have to be done. They can't ignore. That is not a possibility. There is no chance they can ignore any longer.
And is that something to do with how kind of like investor and company relationships are set up like globally in the US? So is that any kind of CEO or board of directors has to respond to investor resolutions? Yeah, kind of, what's the legal framework behind that?
In many countries, such as the United States and Canada, we operate in a legal framework that allows shareholders, if you have enough money in a company, to put forward things like a shareholder proposal. Now, here's what that is. You probably, the folks listening, you know, you've probably gotten emails from our favorite animal group saying, here's our annual report. Look at the great work we did over the past year. Well, companies have something like that, and it's called a proxy. So they go over the revenue, the profit, even things to vote on, like, hey, these are the six board members who are being nominated to be on the board. By the way, most of the time, there's only six board seats if six people are being nominated. So there's not much mystery who's going to be on the board. However, with enough money in a company, you can put forward something to be voted on in that proxy. And so we can put forward things about the treatment of animals. We can put forward things about how the company has misled shareholders, or things that we want the company to be transparent about, things that the company does not want shareholders to know about, let alone vote about, but by law, we can get it on their proxy. And so that allows us to get to the highest part of the company, because by law, those proposals have to go right to the board of directors to analyze. So imagine, you know, someone calls up a company and you talk to the customer service person. Hey, I hope folks do that. But what we do actually goes up to the head of the entire company. And that's the power of our shareholder activism.
I think it's great. It's so interesting. I feel like there's a couple of things that have been kind of concerns over the last few years about the way that advocacy is progressing. And one has been accountability. How can we've got all these commitments, hundreds, thousands of commitments. How can we actually hold companies to account? And the second has been this kind of sense of maybe some of the tactics being a bit stale after a while. We can't keep going back to the same companies with the same, you know, hey, I know we campaigned against you last year for chicken, but now we're coming back with a fish ask. And so I feel like I really love this sense that the Accountability Board has really taken a unique approach and a more sort of creative approach to support the work in parallel that's happening already. Where did you get the idea for this particular type of advocacy to support the movement?
We started this at the Humane Society of the United States. And so at the Humane Society, we became shareholders of companies and we started doing some of these tactics. And that's where we started to realize that at least for any talent that I have or folks on my team, this is, I think, a big thing that we can bring to the holistic work to help animals. And as we started working the Humane Society, we're realizing we're onto something. We really are.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Being at the Accountability Board, we have the flexibility to be even a stronger presence with these companies. So as an example, at the end of my time at the Humane Society, we teamed up with someone named Carl Icahn. He's known as the greatest activist investor the world has ever known. And when I say activist investor, the Wall Street terminology for activist investor is not necessarily activism for humanitarian reasons.
For good.
Sure. Activism to change a company as a shareholder. Like, hey, I don't like this board. I want to wipe this board out. I don't like the CEO. I want him or her fired. That's what their definition of activism is. And he has been the most successful in the history of the world. And it turns out he cares about animals. And so I teamed up with him to go after McDonald's because of them not following through with commitments they made. And you know what? They made some changes. They are now at this point about 90% cage-free in the United States. They're about 90% group housing for pigs in the United States. And that was inspirational for me because we talked with the highest, you know, levels of power within the company when before conversations would be with folks who perhaps were meant well, and perhaps they were sincere in their concerns, but they just had considerable less power at the company. This brought it to the highest levels. And I was thinking, and my co-founder, Matt Prescott, was thinking, what does it look like if that's the only conversations we ever have with companies is at this high level? And this is the type of seriousness we bring to companies. And that guided us to taking this leap at the Accountability Board. And what I can tell you is that as of this taping, we have not been around for even a year, and we've had some of the biggest global successes with corporate policies that I think we've ever seen. And so it's setting us up well for the next months and years to come to see how we can further transfer this type of tactic into global accountability in terms of companies following through with their commitments and also new policies for them to advance and know that they also have to follow through with them as well. So I feel good at what we've done and I feel good about the future.
To get very specific, so would it look like tangibly you guys are buying stock in these companies? So you have to buy some minimum amount of stock to get like onto this proxy. And then maybe in the case of McDonald's, if you can kind of flesh that out. So is there some threat by, in this case, Carl Icahn, that he's going to propose some like nasty shareholder resolution to try to get some people off the board? And then is that the lever with which you're talking to the board directors? And like, what happens if they kind of don't give in to your demands? And who did you speak with? And yeah, how did that all play out? And how do they react to this kind of advocacy?
So with McDonald's, what we did with Carl is that we nominated two people to the board of directors. And so we tried to remove two people from McDonald's board and replace them with people who we thought would do a better job representing shareholder interests when it comes to following through on issues of concern. And while those two folks weren't elected, McDonald's made changes that we were asking. And what we are looking for is change. And I promise you, if none of those actions were taken place, I think a status quo would have remained. What we are doing at the Accountability Board is to change a status quo that I believe will remain for most of these companies if we don't use these levers. I cannot tell you how many times I've met with companies at the highest level, and they have no idea what the policies are that they've enacted in the past. and they have done nothing to fulfill them. Literally nothing. And yet they're still on their website. And yet they still are repeated year after year in their annual reports. But when you actually talk to the people who are meant to implement them, they're like, wait, did we agree to even doing that? And we're like, yeah, why don't you check your report that you put out every year for the last 10 years about this, that you promised to do this. And then they check into it, and then they come back like, okay, well, right now we're at about 0%. Like, oh, okay, you're 10 years. You're at 0% of making your commitment. We're concerned here. I can't tell you how often that happens. And that's why we have to do what we're doing. And I got to tell you, if you had these CEOs on your podcast, which I hope they get on one of these days.
I hope so too.
And they got a little bit of truth serum. I think what they would acknowledge is that they don't think about these issues day to day. They likely barely think of them at all. And if they do, it's only because we bring this to light. And that's how I think we're going to win on the issues, certainly that I care about, is bringing these issues to the highest part of the company in a way they simply cannot ignore. And that's what we do.
Yeah.
One quick clarification is the most, like the commitments that you're targeting the most is stuff on cage-free for egg-laying hens, crate-free for pigs, and also crate-free for veal, for baby cows. Is that right?
So when it comes to animals, yeah, the big issue is ensuring a global cage-free egg industry. For pigs, it's a global, eventually gestation crate-free industry. The other animal welfare reform that we are pressing is related to chickens raised in the meat industry called broiler chickens. And it's to ensure that these animals have more space, have enrichments, have a different genetic breed because their genetics are all messed up from being forced to grow as fast as they're being forced to grow, and also change of slaughter. So that's what we're asking when it comes to chickens in the meat industry. And with many companies is to work with them to diversify their protein, to offer more plant-based proteins, not only for animal welfare, but also for these companies to fulfill their climate change goals. So those are the asks when it comes to animal welfare.
And it's this pressure element, isn't it, Josh? I feel like we've seen this in corporate relations where you sort of get that victory. And I feel like I've felt this position myself where you get the commitment from the company and there's a small sense of the work being done. But actually, there's still so much to make sure that the companies are actually following through. There is that pressure from the day you get the commitment to the day of the deadline. You know, all of these commitments have a timeline and ensuring that they've been followed through. What do you think? So I guess within corporate relations, there's that kind of challenge that you need to follow it through, right, to accountability. Do you think there are limitations to this form of advocacy? And if so, what are those?
Well, first, you're right, Amy, that certainly a mistake I've made in the past is that when I would work and get these commitments, I would be like, oh, great, wonderful. All right, let's move on to the next issue.
Yeah.
Rather than if I could go back in time, what I would tell a younger version of myself is, don't just move on to the next issue. The next step should be, okay, company, we want updates and we want benchmarks of where you're going to be each year. Because what has happened is that company has made a commitment, then we move on to a different issue, then you circle back on the commitment and they haven't done anything on it. And what we are trying to do is not have changes on companies' websites. What we're trying to achieve or that these animals have a much better life, and that's what matters. And if that's not occurring, we're doing something wrong. And so I got to, you know, fully acknowledge that that was a mistake I made that I hope to not make again. And I think that we're doing a better job of making sure these commitments are actually followed through versus just moving on to the next issue. In terms of, you know, limitations, you know, like I want everybody to win when it comes to their work to make the lives of animals better. You know, I'm not in this for the accountability board. I'm in this for the world to be a better place. So there's not, whether it's the accountability board or anything I'm doing politically, nothing I'm doing is going to solve everything. And none of my friends are doing it are going to do it either. it is going to take all of us to bring the talents that we have with strategies that are effective to win the day. So, you know, with us, you know, what I do think that our approach is the most effective approach to get to the highest level of corporations to make changes. You know, at the same time, you know what, like we, the accountability board, we're not working to pass laws. I think they're needed.
Hmm.
You know, we also believe that we need to bring this issue to a higher spotlight in society. And so, you know, organizing more media on these issues, for this to be an issue, not just of folks who just care deeply, but all of society who perhaps aren't yet aware of how poorly animals are treated, but will be on our side. That's not the type of stuff that we're doing. So I promise you, there is so much more to be done, well beyond what my organization is doing. At the same time, I do believe what our tactics are and our strategy is a critical component to achieving what we want on a global scale for animals. I mean, listen, James, Amy, I'm not hosting podcasts, letting people know what's going on, inspiring them. That's you two.
I think you'd be great, Josh.
Thank you, James.
And what are your plans for the Accountability Board over the next few years? What does that look like?
Well, we are going to invest in more companies that are headquartered in other countries and engage them with the activism that is allowed in those countries and per the laws that have been put forward by their governments. We plan to keep going back to the same companies we're working with to make sure they actually follow through what they promised. And, you know, for us, like, we're not short-term investors. You know, whether the CEOs of the board like it or not, you know, we're investors for the long term. And so when we are engaged with a company, we want to work with the company to make sure that they actually follow through with the commitments they made to us and to their shareholders, and then see what's going on in society and make sure they don't fall behind. And so when we look at long term, we're looking at, let's look at one company at a time, and we're working with them short term, knowing that we're going to work with them for perpetuity, assuming, you know, they remain public and we're able to continue to be shareholders, to engage them in that way. And I think that's how we get lasting change. It's not a one-off thing. It's not a, hey, we're a shareholder, we want this one thing, and we'll drop our shares. No, we're going to be a part of this company for its entire existence.
Great.
I'm sure the CEOs love to hear that. You're going to be hounding them for the rest of their lives.
you know what, James? Maybe some view it as an opportunity for them to follow through with their better nature. And they're grateful for shareholders putting them to the standard that they'd be proud to tell their families about. So maybe some might view that way. I don't know, but maybe that's my hope.
I hope so. I mean, you're helping people live their best lives in some way, or at least better lives than they're currently living, which I think is a noble thing. So thank you to you and the team. And you guys are pretty small, right, in terms of how big? It's only a few of you, is that right?
Yeah, well, you know what? It turns out you don't need all that many people to do the type of work that we're doing. And so while there are many organizations with hundreds of people, and that's wonderful, it might fit exactly what they're hoping to achieve. For us, we actually don't need a large team. We need a small team. You know, we have attorneys, we have experts on shareholder advocacy. And beyond that, we don't need too many people to kind of get the outcomes that we're looking for.
That's great.
Very cryptic. What's the number though, Josh? How many people are you?
So it depends on how many attorneys we have at any given moment to work on any given shareholder campaign. So at any time, you know, we could have, you know, close to maybe 10 attorneys working on a given campaign.
Wow.
And that's during especially shareholder season when things are a bit hotter. It comes in seasons, James. You know, it's like usually it's the fall.
Wow.
Yeah. Who knew, right? Who knew?
In terms of the attorneys, you need them because some of the stuff you're drafting is like fairly technical in terms of why the need for attorneys. You can see I have no legal training or background.
Well, one of the reasons why is that I don't have legal training or background either, James. So we do need to bring on attorneys. The reason why is this, is that to file proposals, you need an attorney to really understand numerous things. One, proposals, you can't just have anything in a proposal. There are certain rules that you have to follow that are complex. And so we need an attorney to ensure that we follow the rule in filing proposals. Also, our proposals often get challenged by companies. They don't like them. And so sometimes they try to take legal actions to prevent them from being on that proxy that we talked about earlier. So we need attorneys to fight against them. And this goes, at least in the United States, in something called the Securities and Exchange Commission. And that's the regulatory body of the U.S. government that makes decisions related to shareholder activity. There are other actions that shareholders can use to push companies in a better direction. And so many of these actions, it really takes a real legal understanding to push forward in a way that is allowable and perhaps most importantly, that we're going to win. And so that's why we need a whole bunch of folks working on our side to accomplish what we're hoping to accomplish.
Makes sense. Let's swing back then to the ballot initiatives and US political events generally. We talked briefly about Prop 12, which, you know, I remember, although it seems like a long time ago, right? When you said 2018, I was like, wow, I don't know if it's just the pandemic, but it seems like it was like a long time ago. But yeah, I would be interested. You said rightly that this is some of the most progressive animal welfare legislation in the world. Can you give us an insight into how big the campaign to get Prop 12 passed actually was, and perhaps just touch briefly again on how that works in the US, how the ballot initiative system actually works?
Well, the United States, about half the states allow the ballot initiative process. So that you have to narrow it to even half the states. And in those states, what you can do is that you can collect a government-issued petition and get people's names on that petition enough so that you hit the minimum number needed to get a question on the ballot when people vote in the election. So as an example, in California, we needed hundreds of thousands of registered voters to sign the government-issued petition to get our question on the ballot.
Mm. And the ballots every 2 years, is that right? Depending on whether it's like a federal level or state
right.
level election?
Typically, the typical elections are about every 2 years. And so, yes, if you want a ballot measure, you basically, in most cases, you have a 2 year time frame to get them done. And I mean, the first part of the campaign is going to public parks, it's going to stadiums, it's going to festivals. It's going to wherever people are and just going up to people, and you're humbly asking someone to sign their name and their address on a government-issued petition. And that took literally tens of thousands of hours with more than 1,000 volunteers throughout California doing this. And we got enough to get on the ballot. So once then you get on the ballot, that's when the campaigning begins, when you have real opposition fighting you. And so when they're fighting you, what do they try to do? Well, they put on TV commercials saying basically how Proposition 12 would bring about the apocalypse. You know, who knows why, but they just try to throw everything out there. Okay. All right. So you're battling in the media. You know, there's spokespeople coming out saying about why Proposition 12 is the worst idea anyone's ever thought of. And it's going to do this and that. And so you're battling them, you know, the spokespeople on TV, and you know, they're trying to get the newspapers to write bad stories about it. So what they are trying to do, the opposition, and with Proposition 12, was big animal agribusiness, is to put a seed of doubt in voters' minds, because they know that ordinary people, ordinary Americans, ordinary people around the world, don't want to see animals suffer. And so they have to basically make the case, listen, I'm with you. We don't want animals to suffer either. But you know what? If you vote for Prop 12, oh, you have no idea the consequences that you're gonna face because of it. And then they go through their list. And so during this type of campaign, we have to counter that. And it's intense. It's kind of like someone running for office, but not asking them to vote for myself. It's me arguing for them to vote yes on Proposition 12. So it's very intense. you know, you get polls every single day related to, you know, how you're doing. And, you know, it's almost like the thermometer every day. Like, are you healthy or are you not healthy? And I remember, I still remember this. You'd have every 10 a.m. I would get the latest polling for the last about 6 weeks. And I knew I would always have a little bit of anxiety right before the 10 a.m. happened, hoping that our numbers were good. I just had that anxiety every day for about 6 weeks, along with so many other people fighting each and every day to try to get the vote out, trying to get people to vote yes on Prop 12. And eventually on election day, we just waited for the results to come in, and it was spectacular. We won by a whole lot.
Wow.
And just to be clear on this, Amy, you know, Prop 12 isn't one of the strongest laws for farm animals in the world. It is the strongest law for farm animals in the world. It not only bans the confinement of animals who are raised for pork, eggs, and veal, it also bans the sale of eggs, pork, and veal from caged animals. And that's something that most places around the world, if literally all the places around the world, don't have. And the only other place that's close to it is Massachusetts in the United States that has a similar law. So when you want to pass something that is so strong and transformational, of course it's going to take a big battle. And that's what we were ready to do, and we succeeded.
Just on that, yeah, I think I didn't understand the significance of, yeah, it's not just the production of these products, but it's the sale of these products, which is obviously why, you know, the pork industry was so mad, because it means you can't even farm pigs in Iowa and bring them into California and sell them. That's also off the table. But in terms of this innovation from changing from production to consumption, was there some precedent for this, or where did you get that idea? Or yeah, where did this idea even come from to focus on consumption rather than production?
The first place we tested it was in Massachusetts in 2016. So again, Proposition 12 was 2018. 2 years earlier, we did a similar initiative in Massachusetts. And that was the first time that we ever worked to pass a ballot measure related to the sale of these products. However, before that, there's precedent. You know, there's been precedent about cities and states banning the sale of foie gras. You know, there's precedent about places banning the sale of fur. You know, there's precedent of places banning the sale of dogs from puppy mill operations. So there's certainly precedent on animals. And by the way, in the United States, there's hundreds of years of precedent of states having their own agricultural laws about what can be sold in their state for hundreds of years. Now, they didn't necessarily relate to the treatment of animals, but they related to a whole host of other things. So we had that precedent. And, you know, sometimes you just got to go for it. Really, like, I don't know any social movement ever in history where you didn't have to take a leap to make change happen. And I don't know of any social justice movement in history globally where you didn't have a transformational victory that you could coalesce around to keep moving forward at a higher level than you did before. And so, you know, again, my mind, you know, I'm going to live once. Like, I don't want to regret not being bold. I don't want to regret being too passive. And I felt, and I know certainly others did as well, that we got to give things a shot. And that's what we did with Proposition 12.
Yeah, for sure.
How many animals did it affect, you know, in California?
It certainly affected roughly 50 million egg-laying hens annually.
Wow. 50.
Correct. Also, with pigs, it's hard to know with pigs because, as you all know, just to make sure your listeners know too, not every pig is confined in a gestation crate. The mothers are. And so there's in the United States, there's about 6 million mother pigs who are confined in who are raised in the United States within the pork industry. Most of the 6 million, at least before Proposition 12, you were confined in gestation crates. And so what I can tell you is that for pork producers who wanted to sell into California and Massachusetts, they had to get rid of those gestation crates. So take it for what it's worth, but before Prop 12, it was close to single digits in terms of the percentage of mother pigs who were out of gestation crates. Now, according to the pork industry itself, it's more than 40% of mother pigs in the pork industry who are at least living the majority of their lives outside of crates.
Mm.
Now, a lot of that has to do with corporate policies as well, to be clear. But I think the pork industry would fully acknowledge that these laws certainly have a major reason why they've made the shift that they have too.
And thinking about the polling then and getting that through, causing some anxiety there, getting those figures, did that change the kind of confidence in the campaign as it progressed? And how was that different from how you and perhaps the team and others working on this felt when you first came up with Prop 12 and kind of proposed it through to actually winning? What did that trajectory look like?
Before we waged Prop 12, or before we do any ballot measure in the United States, we want to do polling before we even launch the campaign to see whether we can win. And the polling that we do before we even launch the campaign, it's not some soft poll that shows, oh my gosh, 95% support us because we put the question, we vote for a ballot measure that says animals should be treated well. Now, we're really harsh on the initial polling. We give every argument that I can think of, at least, about why people would vote against Prop 12. Before it was even called Prop 12. And we want to see where people stand. And we felt very good about Proposition 12, that people would vote in favor of it throughout California. Now, I recommend that. That's what I highly recommend for anyone doing legislative work for farm animals, in terms of at least a ballot measure process where people have a chance to vote. Because I feel like we have built so much momentum for farm animals that I don't want us to lose. And I think that if there's a ballot measure that's ever placed, no matter what it may be for farm animals, and we lose, I feel like this isn't the time in the movement's history to give that type of ballot measure a shot. I think we don't do any type of activities where we certainly have a large percentage chance to lose, because we should be building what we've already accomplished, because we've accomplished so much, not taking risks that could set us backwards. So, Amy, I would bring this up to say that polling should be a sober analysis of can we win or not. And if we can't win, don't do it. And if we can win, let's give it a shot. During the campaign, what the polling was very helpful in, because you can't go back in time and rescind the ballot measure, what the polling was very helpful in is what part of the state do we need more advertising or more energy into the state? What part of the state, hey, we're looking good there. Maybe we divert funds to other part of the state where maybe they need to see the message a bit more, or maybe we need more volunteer work in this part of the state. So it was more of a guide to where to go than it was any type of analysis on whether they move forward or not. Because again, at that time, we were already in.
That's so interesting. I feel like I've heard kind of maybe opposing views of there being opportunities where it looks like perhaps it's not going to be successful, but actually just pushing for the campaign, getting the opposition to come to the table, show their kind of responses, be able to have a retort to those, and maybe just sharing and having an opportunity to like share information on a topic with the public could be helpful. So I'm interested that you think that's perhaps like not the most useful use of advocacy.
I've heard the other like kind of angle, which is, you know, this idea of shifting the Overton window, where we'll propose something like very radical and out there, even though we might lose it, but at least it'll shift people's ideas of what's like reasonable or acceptable in society, and like we'll kind of drag ambition higher and higher up. It seems like you're not sure about that because it means we'll lose and we'll lose momentum. And yeah, is that right? And you know, what are your views on this other framing of the Overton window and ambition?
I understand the idea of shifting the Overton window, and I think there are ways to do it without losing. And, you know, when, if people want to do media or, you know, give out leaflets or do social media campaigns or whatever it may be to push issues, great. You know, give it a shot. Putting things out there where there's going to be a vote, when people tangibly say in a vote, no, we are voting against animals, I don't see how that helps at all. If I was animal agribusiness, I probably would be thrilled to have ballot measures where animals lost.
Hmm.
Because they don't, there's no Overton window being changed when the animal side loses. It's the opposite in my mind. It's animal agribusiness is going to go to companies and say, listen, I know you were pressed to make all these changes, but didn't you just see this vote? People aren't so sure about these changes anymore. Hey, didn't you just see this vote? People have kind of changed their mind when it comes to animals. Maybe they thought this way about animals years ago, but look at this vote. There's not nuance when it comes to elections. Either one or you don't.
Yeah, black or white, yeah.
It's black and white. And the more agribusiness says the animal side loses and loses and loses, that is bad for us moving forward. The more we can say, look at all this momentum we build in society, the better chance we have to actually move forward in a way that I think is successful for the long run. You know, as an example, you know, when Ringling Brothers is shut down.
What's that? I don't know what that is.
Oh, I'm happy you asked that, James, because I just assumed everybody knew Ringling Brothers, and I apologize to our international audience. Ringling Brothers is iconic in the United States, as in the most famous circus in U.S. history, and they would use animals in their circus, elephants, tigers, lions, you name it. And after years of campaigning, they eventually shut down, and it made news all across the United States. And why that mattered wasn't necessarily because of the percentage-wise few number of animals being used by the circus compared to farm animals. What it mattered is that people in the United States came to a cultural conclusion that we have changed as a society. We no longer accept certain things when it comes to animals. And that momentum helps on other issues. There's a reason why when we often try to push legislation to deal with issues like dogfighting or cockfighting, things that should be so easy and obvious, animal agribusiness is against that legislation because they don't want any momentum for the animal side, even on obvious things. So that I think for those reasons, we should be aware when we launch campaigns of the importance of winning being a factor.
I totally agree. I think I find that very compelling. And I think you made a good point where you can still shift the Overton window in, you know, like in symbolic demands and things that won't bottom out in some kind of like political votes, even, you know, with his media or even some kind of corporate asks where you think the likelihood of something passing is small, but you know it's not going to result in a public vote. So you kind of spare your image. And I agree with everything you said. I guess one kind of counterpoint is, which I don't know that much about, but I read a book about it, which is the marriage equality movement, which I think they did actually have a few unsuccessful ballot initiatives early on, and maybe had actually quite a few, and then things did kind of change over time. So, I mean, yeah, when I read that, my view was also, oh God, this sounds like a bad idea, but they kind of turned it around. Do you have any thoughts on that? Do you think that was just, you know, it's a different issue, hard to, we shouldn't extrapolate from that? Or do you think there's something in it where, I guess their thesis maybe, you do this thing, you have a public debate, you build momentum from all your active supporters, and then you actually gain the capacity to win further on? Or yeah, do you have any views on that?
Well, Jim, I'm not an expert in the marriage equality movement compared to the animals.
Neither.
I can't tell you, in the United States, the ballot measures were typically done by those against marriage equality, not in favor of marriage equality, because it was helpful for their side to show the public was against it. And they won something like 15 ballot measures in a row.
Wow.
And what really changed, you know, politically, and please, I know society, there's many things that changed it, by the way, you know, in the media, like socially with just family interacting with each other, friends interacting with each other, people getting to know each other more, that helped culturally. But I'm talking about politically, what changed really is that, you know, eventually there was a Supreme Court ruling that ruled that marriage equality was constitutional, and that banning it was not constitutional. And so that's what happened in terms of politically. It wasn't as if those who pushed the ballot measures in favor of marriage equality lost, but that got enough discussion on the issue. That's just not what happened in the United States.
Yeah.
But I think we got to look at it this way, is that I would just look at our opposition. Our opposition tells us how to win. What is our opposition not like? Our opposition does not like winning campaigns. What does our opposition love? they love touting when the animal side loses. They love it. I can tell you, working on state campaigns, I can tell you, working in the United States Congress, there is no email that gets sent faster from animal agribusiness to legislators and their staff than when the animal side loses on something. So why don't we listen to them a bit about how we should conduct ourselves? And what I can tell you on the other side, as in my side and our side who care about the treatment of animals, there's nothing that helps grow that animal issues matter in society than demonstrating success. That's it. Success, in my mind, breeds a type of a go team factor, like, okay, we got this. And all of a sudden, people who were on the team before, like, I want to be part of the winning team too. And then other folks are like, okay, I guess we've shifted. Okay, I guess we got to be part of this too. Momentum matters so much on these social issues. And anything we can do to build the momentum, I'm in favor of. Anything that reduces the momentum goes backwards, I'm against. Hopefully that's an easy calculation on my end, at least.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I was playing somewhat devil's advocate, but yeah, that's a very useful retort and shows my limited understanding of the marriage equality movement. So that's very useful. So thank you, Josh.
So you spoke about the recent challenge, this EATS Act, that's going against Proposition 12. When do you think we'll know more about the results of this, just kind of briefly, and how optimistic are you on the outcome of this challenge?
So the EATS Act is so broad, and not only would it wipe out California's Proposition 12, but every state law that has any type of standard when it comes to the sale of agricultural products. And so when it comes to animals, there's about a dozen states whose laws would be wiped out that ban the sale of eggs, pork, and or veal from caged animals. And so it's incredibly broad. It likely would wipe out laws about banning the sale of puppy mill dogs, potentially banning the sale of fur, foie gras. The list goes on about how horrible this piece of legislation is. We likely are going to see what in the United States is called a farm bill. That's the piece of legislation about agricultural policy. We're likely to see a draft in the fall. And that's where the folks who are pushing the EATS Act are going to try to get it into this big piece of legislation. So we're going to see more about where we're at September and October. We certainly are putting up a huge battle. As of us talking here today, we just announced that we got 171 House of Representative members, Democrat and Republican, to sign on to a letter opposing the EATS Act. And I can tell you there's 30 folks who support a letter in favor of it. So we were hoping just to match that to get 30 to 30. We got 171. And
great.
That shows you how much we're able to galvanize with the United States Congress. I can tell you that another thing that's important for folks who care about animals, as I know we do, is that we certainly have allies that I think are critical that we work with. As an example, I know a lot of folks in the animal protection field are more on the left side of the political spectrum. I got to tell you, if we focus solely on folks on the left side of the political spectrum, we would lose. We have to work with folks on the right side of the political spectrum. And in my view, I want to be Big Ten. I don't, whether you're on the right side, the left side, in between, if you want to work to do something that benefits animals, I think you're part of the team. And in this EATS Act, we need conservatives to speak out against it, because conservatives, at least in the United States, are all about what's called states' rights, local control.
Right.
And the EATS Act would wipe out local control. So we're getting a lot of support from conservatives saying, listen, I mean, this goes well beyond, you know, what is called for here, wiping out my state's ability to pass laws and leaving it just to Washington, D.C. to set these laws on. We're not taking away state rights from my people. So I think that's a real big part of us potentially, hopefully winning, is making a coalition of people on the left side and the right side of political spectrum coming together. And that's one of the things, a great lesson that I certainly learned in my life as I've gone older. And I hope it's a lesson we can all learn from, is that the animals need everybody on their side. And the more we set litmus tests about who can and cannot be part of our team to help animals, the worse off the animals are. And as I think, you know, James may know, I did undercover investigative work years ago. So I worked in factory farms and in slaughterhouses. And when you see firsthand these animals suffer, and you see firsthand these animals being killed, what you want is to find any way to stop their pain. And I would hope that would include working with people who you might not agree with in other issues, but if they want to help animals, I think for the animals, we have to welcome everybody.
Well said.
I'm convinced. I wasn't even against it. I'm convinced. It's very touching, Josh. And yeah, I mean, that letter is very impressive, I think. Yeah, getting 171 representatives, I believe, is super, super cool.
And is this just the sort of status quo now, Josh? Are we just seeing this like endless cycle of seeming like we're having these great, you know, monumental successes, and then a few years down the line, there's these huge backlashes from the opposition, where we feel like perhaps deflated, that all of that work could just, you know, be ground to nothing. Do you think that's the future of this type of work, where we're just constantly in this battle of like feeling like we're just opposing things that we already thought were a big success?
What do we expect? When we're taking on some of the biggest industries the planet has ever known, and their interest is to keep a status quo, do we expect them just to wither away and shrivel in the corner? Of course not. What I expect to happen is that we're going to continue to get advancements as they keep fighting against us and try to reverse them. And at minimum, try to prevent us from getting more advancements. So what I would just say to everyone working on this is the mentality we should have is bring it on. It's the more we say bring it on, the more they're going to start considering maybe we should start shifting in this direction.
Right.
Because they're not backing away these folks. These folks aren't scared. The more it's like, oh, woe's me, we worked so hard on this, it's life is so sad and this world is unfair, that's what the opposition would want us to feel. So what I would tell anyone or any industry, any company who's fighting against me, at least anything I'm trying to accomplish in my life for animals, I say bring it on. And I'm never going to stop fighting until I die. And what I think we should do as a movement, in my opinion, is collectively say bring it on, because we're never ever going to stop to make this world a kinder, more humane place. And we understand we're going to have advancements and setbacks, but I can promise everyone who's trying to stop us is that we are never ever going to slow down in our fight, and we're never going to end until this struggle is complete to make this world a place where animals and people no longer have to suffer and be in pain. So what I would say on that, Amy, is bring it on.
Love it. Thanks, Josh.
It's very touching. I have goosebumps. Cool. Yeah, so Josh, we've spoken lots about, I guess, the importance of political work and, you know, all the monumental wins we've had in the political arena, and as well as the importance of fighting back against some industry backlash. And what would you recommend for people who do want to get involved politically to help animals? And how did your journey start in this arena?
That's a good question, James. What I would say is that anybody can get involved with their local elected officials. And that is so incredibly important, because they often champion the very causes of their constituents. Anyone can do this. And how do you do it? I would, you know, start going to events where your legislator is and introducing yourself. I would invite, and depending on where you are in the world, but a lot of places, hey, invite your local legislator to your house saying, hey, I'm doing a meetup for you. My family, my neighbor is going to be here. I'd love for you to meet your constituents. They often just come over your house.
Wait, and you've actually done this and they've come to your house?
Routinely they do. Routinely.
Really? Wow.
That's
wow.
The thing.
That's very surprising. Actually,
I'm so happy, James and Amy, you reacted that way. Because to us, it's surprising, right? It's like, wait, they come to your house? But guess what? Those who get involved in politics, often from the other side, they know this is how it works. And they're like, oh yeah, this congressperson comes to my house all the time. I do events for that person. Oh yeah, we invite them to this. Oh, my buddy has a bigger house down the street. We have a big party for them. This is what the other side does. But on the animal side of things, we often don't do it. And trust me, most of my life, I was never involved in this stuff either. So it's nothing against anybody. I didn't do it either.
Is this like, you know, federal level, you know, in the UK we have MPs, but also like state level representatives and city levels? Is this kind of like all kinds of people you're talking about?
I would try all levels. Start local though. Start with your local like city council member. And I'm telling you, it is in their interest to meet their constituents. They actually do want to do this because they want your vote. So they want to meet you. They want to meet your family. You want to meet your neighbors. So in a way, you're doing them a favor. So I would just start reaching out saying, if I was just starting, let's say I was in a city and James is my city council member. I would reach out to James's office, say, hey, James, my name's Josh Bach. I'm a constituent. And, you know, I'd love to just do a meet and greet with my family, my neighbors. And it's a big old house. I can get a good solid 40 people there, all constituents, just to meet, you know, council member James. Can I send that invite to the office? And I'm telling you, you're going to be surprised to get the reaction of like, oh my gosh, thanks for reaching out. We would love to do this. I'll get with council member James. We'll get right on this. We'll find a time. That's what I would do just to start. And just get to know the person. And guess what? One day, Councilmember James is going to potentially be MP James. And then maybe one day, Prime Minister James. You never know when your local...
That's right.
Chances are it's going to happen in your life, James. Chances are. One never knows what's going to happen. And at minimum, you're going to have a great relationship with your local council member who's going to champion the causes that you care about. And you can be on that journey with your local elected official on their path to get to hopefully higher and higher marks in government. That's what I would encourage everybody to do. And everyone, of course, in the countries that have this type of democratic process, in those type of countries, everyone can do it. That's where I would say to start.
I love that.
Cool. I'm interested. I'm like, okay, I'm going to go home and going to email my local councillors and MPs and we'll see what happens. But you know, I'll give it a shot. Why not? I will update report in the back. Next. Yeah, in the next maybe few episodes.
See how it
exciting and kind of nerve-wracking. They'll see my house is actually a tiny bungalow flat in London. They'll be like, what is this place? Maybe I'll have to find a friend to host it.
Well, you got to do it somewhere else. We can't invite someone to your tiny bungalow. Go find out. Go find a house to do it in. But beyond that, you'll be good. They're going to be more nervous to meet you than you will be to meet them. Trust me.
We'll see.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Josh. It's been such an insightful episode. I think such a huge and varied career of yours. I'll also say just personally, I think there's not a person in the movement that you say Josh Bork and they say the nicest guy in the movement. You have a really great reputation personally, but then also working on such effective topics and really creative solutions to these issues that we're facing. So just thanks so much for the work that you do for animals and for coming on the podcast to share that with us.
Well, Amy, James, thanks for having me on. It was such a fun time talking with you all. And thank you all for having this podcast. I can't imagine how many people you are going to inspire. So thanks again. Looking forward to hopefully coming on again in the future.